Not necessarily. I like wedding anniversaries. Those things are wonderful. I wanted to take a look at the title of this particular session because the way it reads, it's helping people who don't want help. And we need to be a little bit careful with that title lest we all go running off and do some things we're going to regret. So I've come up with some other options for the title. See what you think. Rather than saying helping people who don't want help, let's call it helping those who need help and don't want your help. Or helping those who need help and just don't want it. Helping those who don't know they need help and don't want you to know they need it. Or last of all, helping those who want you to know they don't want your help. So we're going to see where this goes. But basically, I want it to be stated, we're going to discuss some principles that I think will help all of us help those who we can help, if at all possible. I'm putting all sorts of precautionary words in this. Let me ask you this. Do any of you have a dog at home? How many of you have dogs at home? How many of you have big dogs? Do any of you have a Doberman Pinscher? Doberman Pinscher's over here. All right, I want you to notice a proverb here. Turn over here. Proverbs chapter 16, and I want to read this in just a moment to you. Proverbs chapter 26, sorry. Proverbs chapter 26. All of us know people, I think we do, don't we? All of us are familiar with folks. Maybe you work with them, or maybe you live with them, or maybe they are in your neighborhood. And they're people that you want to try to help because you know they're probably doing something in their life that if they change it, would help a lot. Now let me tell you one of the things that just gets me just a little bit. Not too long ago, I went into a shopping mall, and there was a man with his child on a leash. And I mentioned this before. Does that bother any of you? I mean, it didn't bother. Helping those who don't know they need help. Yes, okay. It bothers me a little bit because I think when I see, I came to the mall and I was over there and this man was leaning against the rail and he had his son on one of those little coiled bungee cords. And it was a long bungee cord and at the end of it was his little son over there. And his son knew that the cord had spring in it. And he would run and he was making a game out of it. And basically the mother was in the little store shopping and he was in the mall tending to their son who was running around being sprung back and forth as they went around. And I thought to myself, that man needs help. Now what do you think would have happened if I had gone over there and volunteered my help? And my help would have been, you know what you need to do? You need to learn how to discipline your child so you're not a humiliation to your child and to yourself. Now that's a little bit costly, but it's along that line. What do you think would have happened? I would have probably ended up at the end of the leash. Now, I want you to read a proverb with me, Proverbs chapter 26. I believe this is the one I wanted. Over in verse 17, a precaution. He that passes by and meddles with strife, belonging not to him, does what? Is like one that takes a dog by the ears. Now, you know what that envisions in my mind? I see myself with a Doberman Pinscher sitting in front of me, sitting down, head up, erect, and I get my face down in front of him and I grab his ears. What do you think would happen? I would end up with more trouble than I reckon for. Do you suspect? I think that's a little bit about what this proverb says, and therein is a precaution, because the one thing I don't want any of us to do as a result of this presentation this afternoon is to go running back to your jobs, running back to your mates, running back to your daughters and sons and doing things that are not wise. Because if you do that unwisely, you'll be like one taking a dog by the ears and you may not be prepared for all the trouble that might come along with that. All of us have people who we would like to help. I've already stated that. And I'd like to tell you a story which illustrates my point, because I'm going to start out with some things that we run into in everyday life. You could probably give a lot of examples, and then I want to talk about some more serious things that the Bible calls sin. And that's where we want to see our brothers and see ourselves, and if we can be helped, then we ought to be helped. I used to work for a man who I wanted to change a little bit. I wanted to help him. And I wanted to help him with just one little small item. It wasn't very large. It was carried around in the thermos. And what it was is he was a minister, and I used to assist him. And he had gone on this little, I don't know what you'd call it. He got off this, he deviated just a little bit from his normal lifestyle, and he got all wrapped up into a health drink. And I'll tell you the reason why this is important to me, is because I used to do all the driving in the car. And he would sit in the right seat. He was pilot, and I was the driver. We'd drive along there. And sometimes to help me stay awake, in my pocket, just like this pocket, I would slip a few M&Ms, little chocolate, you know, that's supposed to melt in your pocket. You put them in there. And every once in a while, if I feel myself getting, of course, I do like M&Ms, I want you to know that. And every once in a while, I get a little bit drowsy, I would go ahead and have one. All right. And the minister, who I happened to work for, would every once in a while throughout the day take this thermos that was filled with a special drink, a health food drink. And I'm not against health food drinks, but I'm illustrating a point here. And in this health food drink were all sorts of goodies. And he'd drink it up there, and he'd take it, and then it wouldn't be too long afterwards, he'd be sneezing and blowing his nose, and his eyes were irritated, and all sorts of things were wrong with him. And he'd look over at me about the time I'd slip an M&M in my mouth. He'd just say, jokingly, but I think there was an edge to it, "Yeah, it's disgusting." I'd say, "What's disgusting?" He said, "Here I am eating a health food drink, watching my health carefully, and you're over there having M&Ms, and you're healthy, and I'm sick." Now, I wanted to help him, but I wasn't able to because my relationship with him was distorted because he was my boss, and he was also a minister, and I was his assistant, and I was not a minister. So I didn't have the freedom, and it may have been my fault, not his, to go ahead and help him. Well, one day, by the way, I did try the drink. I've been creative, and I tried to figure out a way to tell him why it is that I didn't drink that drink. Do you know what I did? Well, first of all, I was over at his house one time, and I watched him make this drink. I watched his wife put it in a blender. It had all sorts of good things in it, but when you got them all mixed up, it was awful. It had bananas in it. It had just, I watched him pour in a whole bunch of honey. He just put in a gob of honey in there. He'd stir in carob in there with it. And then, of all things, he put wheat germ in it. You know, all these things by themselves are good if you're, you know, if you're a plant. So you put all these things in there. He even put peanut butter. It had to be raw peanut butter in there. He'd stir it up, you know, and even the color of the drink. I don't mean to be too vivid about all this. But he put it in, and then he put it in this mug, and that's what he took with him. Now, could I have helped him? Probably. I probably could have helped him. But I knew that I couldn't probably tell him my opinion at that point. I wasn't free enough to tell him my opinion. And I remember one day he offered me some of his drink in the vehicle. He's over there and he took it off, and I think I just popped an M&M, so he was after me. And he said, "Here, why don't you try this?" And he poured some in a little clear glass, and I looked at it and I thought, "Oh." And then I got it this far and I could smell it. And I sort of went, it was terrible. All right, now what he didn't know about me is something I felt about him, and that is that I knew that if I ate something that had a lot of raw milk in it, that had a lot of honey in it, and had a lot of those other things, guess what that does to me? It causes me to sneeze. I mean, that is the way that I am. I know that. And even in spite of the fact that I do occasionally have ice cream because I can't live without it, it's worth the penalty. But I thought, now there's something I could do. I could just tell him very easily. He needs some help because his health was really a little bit on the downside because he was always unhealthy. We were living up in Michigan, so it seemed. And he did not understand. The solution was quite simple. But you know what? I never told him my opinion. Never did. What I could have done, I thought, is to get my own drink and become sick and say, "Boy, I can't believe it. Ever since I've been eating this health food, I'm sick." And I don't know if that would have worked. Do you think it would have worked? Hard to say. But, now by the way, I'm not down on health food. I'm all for it. Please don't bother me. I like peanut butter. I like wheat germ. I like all that stuff in its right place. Not sure I want to drink it, but just so nobody gets their feelings hurt. Now, here's a man in a very trite illustration, but I think it shows a point. Something simple I could have helped him with, but I didn't because my relationship was distorted with him. So one point, and this will be the major point of our presentation or my presentation this afternoon, is this. If you want to help someone, whether they need your help or not, but if you want to help someone and they don't want help or they don't know that they need help, however you want to word it, is you, this is a personal feeling of mine, must cultivate or have, I'm going to put cultivate, a good relationship. Does that make sense? I think that makes sense. If it doesn't, somebody said no, I'll try to explain it before I'm done. There is a need inside of us to try to help people. I have that need, and I think you have that need. You see somebody, like you see someone who has their child on a leash, it's so easy to solve that problem because with a little discipline, that child wouldn't be there, would they? There's solutions, and most of you know the solutions to people's problems, and as a result, you want to help them. Let me read to you a couple of verses, and if you'll turn there with me to a few of these. Let's turn to James chapter 5, first of all. These are verses that instill within us a desire to help people. Now, I want you to help me. I know we have a large crowd here today. Who is it that we're talking about helping? I know all of you here. Who is it that you want to help? Who are we talking about helping? How about an unconverted mate? I think a lot of you would say, okay, how can I help an unconverted mate? My question is, what do you want to help them do? You want to help them, if you have an unconverted mate, and I call it that, you want to help them to become converted. See, that's what, unconverted. Who else do we want to try to help? Parents? We want to try to help our parents? Okay. Parents? I'm going to put parents or children on the opposite side of that. Parents want to help their children.
How about daughter and worldwide?
Daughter and worldwide. There are some things that you just can't do. No, maybe you can. We'll explore that just a little bit. The reason why I say that is I have two sisters in the worldwide. See? I have two sisters in the worldwide, and I want to help them too, see? But I think I've got to figure out how to help them. I'll share it to you. We'll share it with you. All right. Who else do we have here? Parents and children and unconverted. I'm going to put over here. Or your mates. Who else are we interested in helping? Let's put family and friends. I mean, we could just list all sorts of folks here, couldn't we? But I think this pretty much covers it, don't you think so? This will cover us for 40 minutes, believe me. All right, what's this verse over here in James chapter 5? You notice it with me. James 5, one verse that is a part of our Christian heritage. It's something we learn, something we begin to identify with. It says, brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, there comes this expression, you know, converted, unconverted, let him know that he which converts the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. That verse is very important to us. Let's take a look at another important verse. I want you to notice in Jude verse 17. And actually, in these verses, it gives us two principles to use to help folks, to help the unconverted and our mates and our parents and our children. Two principles are brought out here in Jude verse 17, beginning there. But beloved, remember you the words which were spoken before of the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ, how that they told you there should be mockers in the last time who should walk after their own ungodly lusts. These be they who separate themselves sensual, having not the Spirit. But you, beloved, building up yourselves on your most holy faith, praying in the Holy Spirit, keep yourselves in the love of God, looking for the mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ unto eternal life. Now notice what it says in verse 22. And of some have what? Compassion. And compassion does what? You think there's any validity to that? All right, what's the next verse say then? Right after that it says, and others save with what? Fear, pulling them out of the fire, it says. All right, two things are talked about here. Compassion and fear. If you use compassion, that will affect your relationship. If you use fear, that will affect your relationship too. And sometimes, if used inappropriately, you will risk and or forfeit the relationship. You'll always end up with one, but it may not be a good one. So these two verses do play a very important part of our desire to help folks. And the thing I keep thinking about as I say help folks, part of this is because I need help too. You see, you understand that? We're not talking about me helping you or me helping my sisters, because there are times in my life when I need you to help me. That's the way it works, isn't it? I need help too. And so I know what works, at least for me to be helped, and I want to share with you a little bit about what helps me help other people when I have the wisdom and the knowledge to be able to do so. There are some statements in the Scripture that we have to deal with. And I'd like to show you one over here in Hebrews chapter 12, not too far away. Hebrews chapter 12. Turn there with me. We're going to notice in verse 1. What is it that we want to change about the unconverted? What is it that we want to change about our mate? Or let's use the word, what do we want to be different? What is it about our parents, our children, our family, or our friends? I guess we could list all sorts of things, correct? If a person is a good Christian man or woman, what is it that you want to, by Christian, I mean they may not even be a part of our church, what is it that you want to change or to help them with?
Be more like yourself.
More... We have a lot of work to do in this session, I can see that. You know, in principle, though, there's a lot of truth to that. There really is, isn't there? Because that is part of the way we work as human beings. We want other people to be like ourselves because we're so perfect. Isn't it amazing how it works? All right, what is it, if, as I use this illustration about the man who had his child on a leash, what is it that I wanted him to change? What would you say?
He wanted
to stop hurting himself. Yeah, to stop hurting themselves. If I have the knowledge that could keep them from hurting themselves, you want to share that knowledge. And possibly be because there was a time I had my kids on leashes. You know, that's possible. So we want to help people to stop hurting themselves. That's part of our Christian makeup. I think that's what God wants us to be like, too. Now, here's the verse in chapter 12, verse 1, and one of the things that becomes a very important part of our interaction with each other at church. It says, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Now, the reason I read this verse is because most of what we as individuals want to try to help people with are what I'm going to call besetting sins. Besetting sins. And these are not just little things about a health food drink or a kid being at the end of the leash. It's much more serious than that. It's things like drunkenness, where you have a mate who doesn't know they're becoming alcoholic, and you know that they're drinking way too much. Or it might be an example of someone who has a violent, violent, violent temper. And you know that's the reason why they're unstable, they can't hold down a job, and you know that you maybe have a piece of information that can help them straighten their life out. It could be something like someone who, unfortunately, may be addicted to pornographic material. And as they look at it and they read it, it becomes a part of their mind. And you can help them. You can reach out to them. How about somebody who has an ongoing bitterness? You're around them. And you're not around them very long until all of a sudden they just come out almost angry, mad, bitter. Something's inside of them that just wells up, and you don't even ask for it. It just pops out, and you're discussing it with them. And you know that maybe you can make a difference. And so sometimes we will unwisely volunteer our help when it's not going to be appreciated. All of us know people who have besetting sins, and perhaps we do as well. What do we do to help some folks, if we possibly can? The point I mentioned, I'm going to keep mentioning it again and again and again, and that is to build a right kind of relationship. I'd like to ask this question, though, before we go much farther. Why are we obligated to help? Or are we obligated to help? Yes, ma'am? The Bible says two great commandments, really. The first are love toward God. The second, six, are love toward your neighbor and your friend. And God says that we are to love our neighbors. In fact, part of the Passover service, is if you read through John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, is what kind of relationship are we supposed to have as God's people? The relationship of a brother who is even willing to lay down his life for his friend. And that's a pretty serious commitment, isn't it? Yes, we have a need to try to help people because the Bible says, it commissions us, if you will, to love one another. It is a false premise, I want to state this, to say or believe that you can solve someone's problems. Do you know how I mean that? You can't really solve their problem. Who has to solve it? They have to solve it. I'd like to give you an example, which I think is a classic example. It's a true example, as a matter of fact. He was a church, a minister who had a fairly large congregation, and in his church he had about five families who were in terrible financial condition. And it wasn't that they were unemployed. It wasn't that they were out of work. It wasn't that they had lousy work habits. They had lousy spending habits. And the minister was puzzled over it. He didn't know what to do because they were always needing help. Financial help, assistance, groceries, somebody to fix the car, all that kind of thing. And there was no reason for it. So he thought, what am I going to do? And then one day there was a little knock on his door. And two members of his congregation who were accountants came in to fellowship with him, to talk with him. And they said, listen, we'd like to volunteer our services because we're accountants. There are no strings attached at all. We will make an announcement to those who would like to, and we will present a seminar, I'm sure, a lot like what Mr. Dart did this morning on solving your financial problems or dealing with your financial crises or whatever it might be. And the pastor thought, oh boy, I don't know, and because he was worried about things going wrong and maybe the accountants taking advantage of these folks, but he thought he would give it a try, so he did. And sure enough, the five families signed up, along with a couple of others, for help. All right? And the pastor was just tickled his punch over this. He was just delighted. So the accountant sat down. They got out the budgetary expenses of the folks, you know, what the rent is, what their utilities are, what their food expenses and recreation and clothing, all those types of things, listed them all on there. Accountants took care of them. They put them on the budget. The accountants even called the creditors and said, we're working on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Jones. I hope we don't have any Joneses here. But he said, we're working with their account. We're helping them out. And please bear with them until they get their note caught up. Well, the pastor, I mean, it was just, well, this is fantastic. All right? Just fantastic. And the accountants were happy. Everybody was happy. Now, remember, I ask you, can we solve people's problems or do they have to solve the problems themselves? They have to do it themselves. Now, here we have an example of the accountants who had solved their problem, but guess how long it was before things began to unravel? Not long. 1 week went by and it was just fine. The second week went by and it was okay. The third week went by and one of the families showed up in church with a new car. The pastor, you know, didn't know what to do. He just frowned in dismay and went up to the folks to say, listen, what, you know, we were on this thing and the budget and we were doing so well. What happened? Guess why they got a new car? Guess why they got a new car? They got a new car because their old car needed new tires and a tune-up. They said, might as well apply the money to a brand new car. Now, let me ask you this. Had they solved their financial problems? Do you all see the little mistake in reasoning? Let's see, how much do four tires cost? let's say $75 a piece times four, that's $300. And a tune-up costs $50, so $350. That's what it would cost them to get their old car fixed up and running exactly like it should have been. That's a lot of money. So the way not to spend a lot of money is to go buy a new car. And that's what they did. And what I learned from that lesson is this, is that we can present solutions. We can have knowledge. We can have all sorts of assistance. You can even give people money. But who has to solve the problem? They do. And if they don't, should you feel guilty? Sometimes people in God's church do. And you shouldn't. You know, you really shouldn't. So the point I wanted to make is this. We cannot solve other people's problems, but we can certainly help. Now let's turn to a couple of other places quickly. Over here in Romans chapter 5 and verse 6. Romans chapter 5. I'm going to ask the question of you, why is it that we are obligated to help? And maybe you don't feel that you are obligated to help. And if so, that's okay. You don't have to. But there's something that comes to mind here. It's a part of our commission as a church and as individuals. It says over here in verse 6, "For when we were yet without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die." Verse 8 says, "For God commends his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, God did something for us." And the point I'm trying to make is, why is it that we have an obligation to help people? Because there was a time when we didn't know the way either. And I'm glad there was a group of people like you folks who made sure that there was a program and there was literature, and there was a way of life that was brought to my attention. Because otherwise I wouldn't be here. And that may be all I can do to help, is to be a part of this church, be a part of this organization. And then 10 years from now, 15 years from now, someone will come along as a result of what all of us are doing collectively together. Now there's an obligation here for us to do what we can do for people who are yet sinners, because there was a time in my life when I would have gone out there and met that bunny. Now, see, there's so many illustrations to give. I mean, just here being here at the feast, you know, some of us want to straighten this hotel out. But they really don't want our help. They want our money. That's what they want, you see. Although they're very kind and very helpful to be a part of what we're doing here. All right, let's come to another verse over in Job chapter 6. Job chapter 6. Do all of us agree that there was a time when we didn't know the way either? And I'm talking about, as the way, I'm talking about the truth as you and I understand it. But there was also a time in our lives I didn't really know the principles that make life happy. But I've learned them in God's church, and I hope to learn more as time goes along. What about the folks that have left? Because that's a question that comes up. You know, we talk about our daughters and our sisters who are part of another church, or maybe they're part of the Catholic Church, and you want to reach out to them and you want to help them. Or sometimes it's folks who have been a part of our church and have left. Notice what it says here over in Job chapter 6, over in about verse 14. It says, "To him that is afflicted, what? Pity should be shown from his friend, but he forsakes the fear of the Almighty." One translation presents it this way: "A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty." A friend is a very good relationship. And I hope that all of us are mindful of that, that though people may not necessarily agree with us theologically or philosophically, they've gone their own way, that they are still our friends, and we demonstrate to them that we are here. And we're here to help if we possibly can. Okay, another verse I want you to see is over in Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. And this is the one that wears heavy with me, and I'm sure it does with you too. Galatians 6 and verse 1. "Brothers or brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. And I know there are going to be exceptions to what I'm going to say, and I don't have time to deal with all the exceptions, but let me illustrate it this way. If you are a new person in the church, and you see someone in the church maybe overtaken with a fault, is it your place yet to go and try to straighten them out? Probably not, because what has not been established yet? A relationship has not been established yet. Once the relationship has been established, then guess what you can do? You can go and talk with the person and help them. And they will hopefully respond to you. If you see someone overtaken in the fault, you which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. That deals with the attitude that you come to them in. Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Do you think prayer works? Okay, yeah. One thing that I guarantee you works is prayer. I don't want to do much talk, but it is. It's prayer. And I know I've heard Mr. Dart mention this, and it's so true. Mr. Armstrong as well. But one of the best ways to help people who don't need help is to pray for them. Because that's something they don't know is going on. Isn't that correct? And if you get down on your knees consistently enough to pray about someone, what automatically happens to you? You're helping yourself, you're changing your attitude, and you are establishing in prayer a what with that person? A relationship with them. I mean, don't you know the feeling when you come up to someone and you know that a couple nights ago you were praying with him and you weren't praying for God to get him? You were praying about the person. You come up and you meet him and you look him eye to eye and you know that you prayed for them, but they don't know it. But it does something to you, you know, because you spent time on your knees talking to God about this individual. You develop a relationship. When do you think we ought not to intervene at all? There are times when we should just not intervene. One of the times we should not intervene, it's just a part of what I'm saying here, is when you do not know the person. When you do not know the person. I know that may sound too simple, but if you don't know the person, it's probably not going to be helpful to intervene, because you might as well just pick the dog up by the ears. They don't know you. Because correction sometimes is difficult enough to take from a very close friend, much less from a complete stranger. You agree with that? Okay. So one of the points that's a spin-off of what we're talking about here is to develop a relationship. Now, I read a story. It was interesting to me, and I don't know if this was the best solution. I'll pass it on to you. It was a story about a woman. She was up in years a little bit. By that, I don't know how old she was. But she had her children reared, and she went into a shopping store where there was the grocery store, and the cart down the middle of the aisle, and there was a woman down the aisle whose child was absolutely out of control. Have you ever seen those? You know, you just want to shake them, get them all straightened out, interrupt you, and, you know, stuff them with Jell-O or something, take care of them. And you want to go up there and help the lady. Now, she looked at it and she thought, here's a situation that's completely ridiculous, complete stranger to this lady. She knew that she had no relationship with her at all, so what could she do? She thought about it. She really pondered what she should do. And I like her creative answer. She went down the aisle where all the confusion was, and she sort of looked over there, and not judgmentally, and just said to the woman, she said, you know, your children are really cute. They remind me of my own children. And they are difficult to deal with sometimes, aren't they? I mean, this woman didn't know what to do with an answer like that. I mean, nobody had said that about her kids in a long time. And all of a sudden, she was aware that her children were out of control. Because, you know, it's amazing to me, because these are one of the groups of people we like to help, our children. Have you ever noticed how many times we as parents are not aware of what our kids are doing? Have you ever noticed that? I'm talking about myself, too, because I've got two, and I don't know what they're doing right now. But I do remember something. Tell me how we solve this problem. Oh, wise counselors, which we are. One time in my home, I wasn't there, thankfully. But my wife was there, and we had a relatively new coffee table. And my wife had an unexpected visitor and her daughter drop over to the house, which is fine. That's good. Ministers are supposed to be hospitable. You know, we took the chains off the door and let her in. So She came in there and they were talking. And the next thing you knew, this little child had gotten into its mother's purse and had gotten, what's that stuff you women put all over? Powder, this white powder you put on your faces. Comes in the big ball. And this little child had it and flung it on our new coffee table. And the mother is standing there watching, or sitting there watching all of this. All right, now here's a person who needs help. My wife was watching, you know, what's going on and trying to, with her eyes, at least gesture with her eyes that something is going on the coffee table. Because the next thing you know, the little girl saw that the powder was all on the coffee table. So you know what she did? She got up and started dancing on the coffee table in the powder. The mother never even knew it. You find that hard to believe? I find it real hard to believe, because I know what would have happened if I had been there. There'd have been some powder somewhere else, I'm afraid. We all go through these things. People who need help. Sometimes they're little children. Sometimes they're adults. Sometimes they're our mates. Sometimes they're our unconverted friends. We have to help them. Now, I want to tell you something. It's over here in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I believe, or actually 1 Corinthians chapter 5. These verses follow the Apostle Paul's instruction regarding the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. It seems to be appropriate, does it not, for us right here to consider this? Because in all seriousness, there was a man in the church who had been guilty of committing incest with his own mother. He had been... What was the solution? What was the Apostle Paul's solution? He put him out of the church. Did he not? So what was the best way to help that man? He put him out of the church. The best way to help the church then was to put him out of the church too, but he's still dealing with a problem. And I wanted to read these verses to you, especially during these days of unleavened bread, because sometimes there are those of our number who are quite frustrated, if not disturbed, over the relationship that they have in the church, and they don't understand it. But I want to say it this way, because these verses compel us, just as much as the other verses to compel us to help, these verses also compel us to help in another way. You see, let's read these verses. Verse 8 says, "Therefore let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with what? The unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." He says, "I wrote to you in an epistle not to company with fornicators, yet not altogether with the fornicators of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or with idolaters, for then must you needs go out of the world. But now I have written unto you not to keep company if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator, or covetous, or an idolater, or a railer, or a drunkard, or an extortioner." The Bible says to all of us that we are supposed to do what? With such a one, no, not to eat. Those are unpleasant verses. Those are very unpleasant verses, because none of us like to really obey these verses, especially if the person involved is a very good friend. It's difficult, isn't it? But I mention this because in our church growth, people sometimes sit back with a sense of puzzlement. They don't understand why it is that they are given the reception and or treated the way they are in the church. And it's not a judgmental action. It's just a matter of fact that the people in God's church are bound to this. And we are careful, are we not, of who we fellowship with? Are we not? Like, I might ask any of you, I mean, do you really enjoy being around somebody who gets drunk all the time? No, you don't. I would think that you wouldn't, because it makes you uncomfortable. Would you be comfortable around someone who is a fornicator and maybe talks about it a lot? I would think not. One of the things which I instruct my children about, my oldest one all the time, I say, if you run with a certain crowd of people, you will what? Most likely become like they are. You agree with that? It applies in Christianity too, doesn't it? So these verses are back here too, especially as I look at it during the days of unleavened bread, because I have accepted the fact that one way, even though I may even have a strong relationship, I'm going to talk about that just a little bit, how you talk with a person, but sometimes I have no recourse. I don't ever stop praying for them. I don't ever stop maybe staying in touch with them. But one thing I am compelled to do, I cannot become a partaker of that sin. And that's painful. That's very painful sometimes. All right, let's go on here just a little bit. What about this statement? We tend to believe that even enough time, we can love people enough and pray hard enough and work hard enough to help anybody. What do you think? Work hard enough, love hard enough, that you can change them eventually. Not so. It just isn't so. Now, God can change them. They can change themselves, but basically you and I are not going to change them. Okay. So, with all this introductory material that I've talked about, what can we do then to help those who don't know that they need help and need it, or who don't want your help and yet you know you can't help it? I mean, how do we just help people? Okay, that's certainly true. Well, don't forget this thing. I mean, that's really important, isn't it? Okay, we got this one covered. Praying for it. We all got this. Okay. The next thing is your example. Let me tell you a statement that I happen to really believe. The best form of counseling is your life. That's the very best form of counseling. If you want to counsel someone, you know someone is having marital problems, what's the best form of counsel? It is a happy marriage. If someone comes to you and they're having a problem with drunkenness, or you know that they're drinking and doing things on the sly, how do you help them? Well, maybe you've been through the problem and you can identify with it and they know it, and then you might have a means to help them. We, as concerned brethren, have got to do these things, prayer and example, but then also another part of it, it affects our church, is to make sure that we have, as a group of people and individually, the right attitude and atmosphere created in our churches to accept people who are less than perfect. Because guess who that is directed to? Us too. But do you know what I mean by this? I mean, if somebody comes into your church, maybe they're relatively new, or maybe they're old, or maybe you learned that they started to work on the Sabbath, you don't say, "Whoa, wait a minute, whoa. What did I hear you say? Working on the Sabbath. Why, you, I can't believe it. You've been in the church for 25 years, and all of a sudden you're working on the Sabbath. What's wrong with you? You insane?" No, we would never go to that extreme. But have you ever seen the looks that pass between members who don't agree with what they hear someone saying they're doing? Have you ever seen those? It can be pretty direct. I mean, words are bad enough, but I've seen some looks that just slice you up in little pieces. You know, "I'm sorry I'm alive. You know, give me a rock to crawl under." Now, in the church, we have to recognize that we have to have the right kind of an environment here so that people can fellowship among us and learn a better way. Now, how do we create that right kind of an environment? That's an interesting question. Do we permit sin in our midst? I mean, where we know about it. Sin goes on. We know that because we're all sinful human beings. But if someone were to come into our church services today and be drunkard, what would we do?
Ask him to leave.
Or help him or her leave. That kind of thing. Would that be wrong of us to do that? Probably not, do you think? In fact, it might even help them. All right, well, what about the other things that go on in the church? There are just some behaviors that are just out of line in our church. And we need, there are certain things that we need to understand that, okay, people will learn more about the Sabbath in time. They will learn more about chaturanga in time. They will learn more about keeping God's holy days in time. They will learn more about tithing in time. And so we create an environment where we're not put off by what they don't know yet. Right? Because there was a time when I didn't know anything either. And I'm not so sure I know very much yet. But there was a time when I knew far less than I do now. And I'm grateful and thankful that there were a number of people who were tolerant of what I didn't know yet and helped me. And we developed a relationship over time that let them help me, and I've been able to reciprocate in time. Is there ever a situation that comes up that is beyond your depth to help? You think? Okay. The question, I'm saying two things. When should you not be concerned about helping people? I mean, you want to help and you can help them in prayer and your example. But I mean, you don't go up to them and say, listen, I'll use Dennis. Well, Dennis, come here. I got to tell you something. Red's out. And he's wearing red here today. And there was a time years ago when, as maybe some of you know, that you didn't wear red or pink if you were a man. Remember those days? Yeah, I remember those days because I went into my closet and yanked out all my new shirts. Trash canned them. I think Dennis got them. I'm not sure. Mine looked just like that. That was a long time ago. Two things, when not to intervene, when you don't really know the person, and when the situation is beyond your depth. You see, it amazes me sometimes, I'm talking to even some ministers and certainly other people, and they try to get involved in things that are way over their head. I've even met some people who seem to get involved and or excited with someone who is demon-possessed. And they sort of just rush in to help. I'll tell you something. The last thing I want to do is rush into where I know that somebody is really demonic. I don't like what could happen. But yet, we sort of want to help and help. But there comes a time where you just got to pass the baton and give it to somebody else who knows a whole lot more about it. You see? A whole lot more about it. I like this little sign that was put up in a textile mill. And the sign was very simple. It said, if your thread gets tangled, send for the foreman. A new worker came in, happened to be a lady. And it wasn't too long that all her threads got tangled up. And so she tried to solve it herself. Came to the attention when the line had to shut down that the foreman came over and said, why didn't you call me sooner? She said, well, I did my best. I love his answer. He said, your best was to have called me. And he was right. And sometimes that applies in the church, that you really can't help an individual, but you have to defer it or give it to someone else, someone who has had experience and would know how to talk to the individual. All right, let me very quickly, as we wrap things up here, how do we go about then creating this right kind of an atmosphere in ourselves and in our church, maybe in your own family? Do any of you recall back when your children made bad mistakes, or maybe they weren't so bad, and your child would come up and she's got tears in her eyes and she's got the bath dispenser in her hand and she says, Daddy, I put too much weight on it and it broke. Well, what do? You don't spank her, do you? I mean, she's coming up confessing her sin, isn't she? And, you know, you just sort of understand and you go back. Now, if she breaks one every day, it might be a little bit different. But I'm just using this one example where they go up and in innocence they lean on it and they come up with the very problem in their hand. And you just understand it and you forgive them. One of the things that I think is important for us to recognize about creating a right atmosphere conducive to change or helping other people is to let people know that it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to eat health food that makes you sick. It's really okay. I mean, that's up to you if you want to do it. It's really okay if you didn't discipline your child right every time, isn't it? I mean, you'll pay, but I mean, you're going to make mistakes. We all know that. It's okay because we know we make mistakes. It's okay, maybe, I'm going to be on a limb on this, not to have bought your wife a ring for her 18th wedding anniversary. I mean, that's okay, isn't it? We don't know. Well, I've created a problem for you. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, I think that Mrs. Kern's ring, if I look closely, this is their 18th. It had 18 little stones on it. Let's see, this is your 43rd. Oh, just throwing out ideas. Do you understand my point, though, about letting people know that it's okay to, as a part of our church, it's okay to hurt. It's okay to experience a little bit of pain. Because this is not a sterile church without feeling and emotion and compassion. Because one of the things that the Scripture said that's important that can help people is compassion. And I would like to think that the majority of us are on the strong side of compassion. And I think probably most of us are. Because we kept the Passover, we keep the days of unleavened bread, and we have that lesson burned into our memory. It's okay to hurt, isn't it? Is it okay for a woman whose husband has left her to come to church and be distraught and be emotional and be misdirected and be confused? Or do you see her and she comes through there and you say, well, you know, if you just believed in God, you wouldn't feel this way. Well, wait a minute, you have your mate leave you. And, you know, we'll get the jacket out for you too, you know, the one that ties you all up. In other words, it's just like the story of the young man who came to the minister and he was very, very hurt and confused and misdirected. His girlfriend had broken up from him. His job was on the verge of being lost. And he all had all sorts of other kinds of problems. Does he have a right to hurt and to have pain? Yes, he does. And do we understand that? You know something, if you come among a group of people who really do have compassion and they understand human suffering and human pain, you can identify with that. If you come up to a group of people who don't understand that, it's difficult to stay. And they'll go somewhere else for help. The second thing I wanted to bring out is this, the importance of your example in church, how you live your life, how you live with your mate, how you live with your children. That'll send a tremendous message out to those of our own number, whether new or old. Going along very quickly here, let me ask you this. One of the things that's on here, I want to touch on this. What's something that we can do to help those with unconverted mates? How about this? A couple of ideas that people have thrown out to me, and I like it, just to be a little creative, because one of the things I want you to think about is there are things that we can all do if we'll just sit and think about it and be responsible. One of the things I like, if you have an unconverted mate who you want to like the people in the church, is invite someone in the church over to your home who they might like. For example, if your husband, who's unconverted, you know, let's put that in quotes because I'm not sure I like that word, but, you know, they're not a believer of the church. Let's say they like fishing. Well, invite somebody over to the house who likes fishing who doesn't come in. The first thing to do is open up the Bible and start preaching to them. Unless they're preaching about where they all went fishing. You know another thing which I really like? To help those that have unconverted, if you're willing to give it a try, this might be risky, invite the minister to come over. And let your mate see that the minister is okay. And he's not like you probably think he is. The unconverted. Is that risky? Who's your minister? Oh, no. Sorry. Don't answer that question. It might be risky, so you've got to evaluate these things very carefully. This, we could talk about it by the hour, but I want to come back and wrap things up, and I want to tell you a concluding story, a little statement which I think tells a lot. The point I've been trying to mention, if you want to help people who don't know that they need help or who need your help and don't know it, the best way you can do it, I really firmly believe this, rather than the exceptions, is to develop a good relationship with that person, because then most likely they're going to listen to you. And even then, sometimes they won't. Okay? Develop a good relationship. Work at it. Have them over to your house. Laugh with them. Don't judge them. Have fun with them. Be serious with them. Stay up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, if you will, and talk about really the important things of life. And that draws you together. You couple that together with prayer, and you've got something that's working. Working dynamically. But that's something that you have to do. All right, the final thing then that helps us develop an atmosphere where people can be helped is to encourage people to self-disclose. You know what? Mr. Darts talked about this. You know what self-disclosure is? That's where you trust someone to tell them what's really going on inside of you. It's not a confession, but to risk talking to someone about your feelings. We don't do that too often because we make ourselves vulnerable, and when we make ourselves vulnerable, we are afraid of being hurt, because I've seen it happen. Someone goes, I remember one time a long time ago, and I'm not going to mention anybody's name, though you may be here. No, you're not. But I remember a long time ago, I mustered up all my courage to tell a very intimate, private, personal, embarrassing, I don't want anybody to know, but I felt I had to tell somebody's secret. I was in school. And I finally did it. I went to school Monday. Guess what? Everybody knew. Everybody knew. Do you think I wanted to self-disclose to that person anymore? Not at all. So we need to get to the point to where we can let our feelings be known to a few and let them know that it's okay to be human beings and love each other and care for each other, but don't take advantage of anybody's willingness to talk to you. And in time, those people become known in church. You know that? We know who we can talk to and who we can't. We know who we can trust and who we can't trust. Okay, I'm going to close with this story. because I think this illustrates my point. Story of a little of a father and a son, true story. And this father liked fishing, and his fishing rod on his garage door. Okay, I mean, that's where it was. He actually had wanted to put it away, and he backed his car out of the garage door, and all of a sudden he backed out, and apparently when the garage door opener had come up, the fishing pole was in such a spot that it fell down, and when he backed over, he heard it go slap. And he got out of the car and looked over there, and instead of one long rod, he had two. And he goes in there, and he comes in, and he says to his son, "Come here." His son came over, 5 years old. And he said, "Who used this last?" And his son looked at him and says, "Well, I did." And he said, "Where did you put it?" And he said, "Well, Daddy, I put it in the garage, but maybe I didn't put it up where it should have been." And his father said, "Oh, okay." And he walked out and he got back into the garage, into his car, and drove away. 2 days later, the mother was out shopping with her son. And they were going along in the store there, and the son looked up at the mother and says, "Mommy, we need to go into the sporting goods store because I've got to buy Daddy a fishing pole." And her mother said, "Well, what for?" And he said, "Because I broke Daddy's." She said, "Well, you don't have to do that." And he shoveled out his $2, which was his life savings, and gave it to his mother. And he said, "Yes, I do, Mommy, because I learned that Daddy loves me more than he does his fishing pole." That happens in church too. Teach people, if you want to help them, that you love them more than their mistakes.